Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The impact of COVID-19 on jobs has been much worse than expected, the UN Labour Agency said on Tuesday. In an appeal to governments, workers and employers to support a sustainable and fair economic recovery plan, the International Labour Organization, ILO, said that the world is not likely to be in better shape by the end of 2020 than it was before the health crisis. New data from the ILO shows that working hours fell 14% during the second quarter of this year, from April to June, equivalent to the loss of 400 million full-time jobs. Last month, the agency pointed to a likely loss of around 305 million jobs. Regionally, people in the Americas have been worst hit, with working hours down 18.3%. Although massive stimulus packages have supported workers and industry since the pandemic began, ILO Director General Guy Ryder warned that least developed countries have been passed by.
Whilst, as I've said, $10 trillion have been spent on stimulus spending, this has been highly concentrated. 88% of that total has been spent by advanced countries. On advanced countries, it's spending on your own economies. That's the equivalent of about 5% of GDP. The equivalent figure for developing and emerging economies is 2.2%. For the less developed countries, it's much less. And as the pandemic hits a developing world with increasing ferocity, I think that mismatch is going to be more than ever evident.
The UN Human Rights Council should consider new accountability measures against those responsible for extrajudicial killings in the Philippines' so-called war on illegal drugs, the United Nations top rights official said on Tuesday. Michelle Bachelet's appeal comes after a report by her office indicated that many thousands of people have been killed in police and vigilante operations since 2016. According to Ms. Bachelet's office, the campaign against illegal drugs has been linked to the deaths of 73 children, the youngest 5 months old.
The campaign against illegal drugs is being carried out without due regard for the rule of law, due process, and the human rights of people who may be using or selling drugs. The report finds that the killings have been widespread and systematic, and they are ongoing.
In February 2018, the International Criminal Court announced that it intended to open a preliminary examination of the situation in the Philippines. On the opening day of the Council's 44th session, Ms. Bachelet also reiterated concerns over proposed new anti-terror legislation that are now before President Rodrigo Duterte. She urged him to refrain from signing the law and instead draft legislation that can prevent and counter violent extremism, while also preventing its misuse against activists exercising their right to demonstrate peacefully. Female genital mutilation must be stopped, along with child marriage and other harmful practices which millions of women and girls are subjected to every year. That's the urgent appeal from the UN Population Fund, UNFPA. Its latest State of the World Population report cites at least 19 practices against girls and women that have been almost universally denounced. These include breast ironing and virginity testing, said UNFPA Geneva Director Monica Ferro, who added that this year, more than 4 million girls are at risk of genital cutting, and one in five marriages today involves an underage girl. But she said that the tide is turning.
More and more people are defying the persistent hold of harmful practices. Parliamentarians are passing effective laws. Traditional practitioners are putting down their tools. Mothers and fathers are choosing to keep their daughters in school. Community leaders are telling friends and neighbors to protect girls from violations of their humanity. The rights, choices, and bodies of girls, these are their own.
Although some progress has been made in ending some harmful practices worldwide, COVID-19 threatens to reverse these gains, Ms. Ferro said. In particular, the pandemic could lead to an additional 13 million child marriages between now and 2030, according to UNFPA, with potentially skyrocketing numbers of women unable to access family planning clinics and susceptible to gender-based violence and other harmful practices. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
America enters uncharted territory for pandemics, especially in the South, where it's very hot, well over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, day after day, 38 degrees C. An unusual dust storm from the Sahara may cool things down a little bit, but that adds more respiratory problems for millions of lungs already in danger from COVID-19. In a Woods Hole seminar last week, American scientist Zach Zobel projected the U.S. southern states will go well beyond the zone where humans can survive outside for months at a time in the coming decades. No problem. Everyone goes inside with air conditioning, as long as the grid stays up. If the power goes out for more than a week or so, millions could flee north. That's because more than a billion humans are already on the ventilator, breathing machine-driven air. As we will discover in the next three interviews, that isn't sustainable, and it only makes the world hotter and hotter. Is a Best of Radio EcoShock replay heading for air-conditioned hell. Stage 1, the Earth gets hotter and hotter due to growing greenhouse gas emissions. Stage 2, humans cool themselves artificially with machines. Stage 3, air conditioning makes the world even hotter until we run out of fossil fuels to run them or extinction takes us down. It's an obvious progression, another adaptation to what we've done. I counted air conditioning as a minor factor, another irritant to living systems. Now I've learned it's a major vector, a force that could help tip us into runaway climate change. Everyone knows air conditioners suck up lots of energy, most of it powered by coal. We've heard rumors a billion people in Asia are buying them. I've known for 20 years the refrigerants are super warming gases, but hey, these tiny amounts hiding in the back of our fridges and air conditioners, it can't amount to all that much. Wait until you hear the truth about air conditioning. We've got three powerful interviews. Stan Cox is the author of The Best Guide, a book called Losing Our Cool. His latest article in the Guardian newspaper gives us the global picture. Dr. Gus Velders is from the Netherlands Environmental Assessment Agency, and he advises world bodies on ozone depletion and climate change. We're lucky to have him as a guest. Dr. Michael Sivak from the University of Michigan wrote the best studies on the global growth of air conditioning. We'll hear from all three. Are we heading to air-conditioned hell? I'm Alex Smith. Tune in to our guests this week and find out for yourself. Then we'll wrap up with a new song from the Dave Matthews Band, which captures our situation so well. It marks a turning in our programming from fear into action. A Best of Radio EcoShock replay. Pardon me if I rage against the machine. In November 2010, Radio EcoShock interviewed Stan Cox, author of an excellent book on the overall impacts of air conditioning. It's titled Losing Our Cool. We mostly talked about the United States, how air conditioning has changed the way people interact and the huge amount of energy wasted. Stan's authority on air conditioning has gone global, just as air conditioning is exploding in the developing world, including China and India. His most recent article for Yale 360 was republished in Britain's Guardian newspaper. It's a scary read with a little-known twist that could help tip us even further into runaway climate change. Stan Cox is a senior scientist at a nonprofit agricultural research institute in Salina, Kansas. Stan, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Good to be back with you, Alex.
Well, this past June, Stan, I was in Page, Arizona, and it hasn't rained there for 2 years. The temperature was 104 degrees in the shade, 40 Celsius, and it was punishing. When people stopped for coffee, they left their vehicles running to keep them cool. The streets were deserted by 10 in the morning. It was just too hot. Everybody spends the day hiding in some air-conditioned building. So the last time we talked, I asked whether there might be a mass exodus of people from the American Southwest if electricity prices get too high, and now we're into a series of record hot years, the hottest July in American records. I'm still wondering, how long can the Sun Belt residents keep their cool? What do you think?
Well, the migration into Arizona, for example, which went on for more than half a century, finally did come to an end in 2008-9, and as far as I know, their population has either held steady or maybe even begun to decrease. Now, that had a lot to do with the big recession, not necessarily all to do with the heat, but you look at what they just went through here in recent weeks, and I'm wondering the same thing. How long can they keep it up? One place they probably won't be coming is Kansas, where we had 33 days or so over 100 Fahrenheit, and most of those were over 105 this summer. It was definitely not just across North America, but in Kansas in particular, it was the hottest summer ever.
Wow. Well, your article for Yale 360, I read it in The Guardian. It took us out of America and into a whole new world of air conditioning. Where is the big growth of air conditioning now, and can you toss some numbers at us?
Yes, right now, in recent years, the United States has been using about as much energy for air conditioning as the rest of the world put together, but that's changing very fast. It's predicted that China will surpass us in air conditioning use by 2020 or so. And you can think of it this way. The number of U.S. homes equipped with air conditioning rose from 64 million to 100 million between 1993 and 2009. So over 16 years, we added 36 million homes with air conditioning. In 2010 alone, there were 50 million air conditioning units sold in China. There's a boom going on similar to that in India as well. And China is expected to have 100 million air-conditioned vehicles by 2015. The city of Mumbai in India, one of the world's largest cities, now 40% of its electricity use overall is going to air conditioning. And it's still just a small part of the population who lives or works in air conditioning there. The people who've been making projections about the future say that 2020, 2025, probably China will reach the saturation point that the United States has reached, where our now 90% of homes are air conditioned in this country, and probably the other 10% may not ever need it. China is reaching that point in the coming decade or two, but then they say the big growth will be in India, Southeast Asia. And it'll be to the point that by 2050, the world could be using 10 times as much energy for air conditioning as is being used today worldwide.
So we take the total energy we're producing right now with all those climate change emissions, and we multiply it times 10 just to run the air conditioners by 2050?
Well, it's 10 times the amount of electricity we're using now to run air conditioning.
Okay.
We'll be running then, but that will be, at that point, that's half as much electricity as we use for everything right now. So it will be like adding 50% to the amount of air conditioning we use now. And that's just for buildings, not counting vehicles.
And as you know, Stan, the whole of northern India just suffered one of the world's biggest power blackouts. Electricity for 700 million people went off, sometimes for a few days, and a lot of that was due to demand for air conditioning. What can you tell us about India's love affair with cooling now?
Well, traditionally, and still, I think it's probably only 1 to 2% of households who have air conditioning. I lived in India in the 90s, and I've been going back there regularly since then. And where you really see the increase in air conditioning is in the big cities, in office and commercial space. And it's played a big role in the economic boom, but that boom has really benefited a pretty small portion of the Indian population. The people who have benefited from that are going for air conditioning in a big way. And the projections of the global economists say that there are going to be a lot more people in India in the future with enough money to air condition as well.
And you found some other countries that we wouldn't suspect that are also growing in air conditioning use.
Well, yeah, some of them that maybe you would expect, like Saudi Arabia, is before long be burning more oil within the country than they export, believe it or not. And a lot of that could be attributed to air conditioning. Interestingly, the people who've made the projections about global increases in air conditioning are saying that Latin America may not really have big increases. I'm not exactly sure why that is. with the exception of Mexico. Mexico is already has a lot of air conditioning, and that's supposed to increase dramatically. But most of the increase they are projecting will be in Asia, and especially in the tropical countries of South and Southeast Asia.
And have you done any sort of back-of-the-envelope calculations about how much greenhouse gas emissions are coming from this global use of air conditioning even now?
You can kind of get some pulling numbers out of various scientific articles and surveys. My best guess is that worldwide, the current output of greenhouse gases, both from the power plants that run air conditioning and from the refrigerants that are circulating in the air conditioners and from the gasoline in the cars running air conditioning, if you put all that together, it's the equivalent of about a billion metric tons of carbon dioxide per year. And about half of that is the United States. Now that, as I said, is projected to go to maybe 10 billion tons in the future, and most of that will be elsewhere.
Yeah, I guess people don't realize as soon as you snap on your car air conditioner, and in fact, just having it there running all the time off the fan belt, so to speak, is costing you gas mileage.
Well, the federal agencies that study these things say that when you're running the air conditioning on high and kind of a what their standard driving route of urban highway driving, a kind of a combination, when the air conditioning's on high, it increases your fuel consumption by over 20%. People always like to discuss the situation when you're on a long trip on the interstate driving continuously at 70 miles an hour because with the windows rolled up, you have less wind resistance. People say, well, running the air conditioning with the windows up is about the same as having the windows down without it. And that's probably true. Various people who've looked into it, including the Mythbusters on TV, when you average out all those investigations of this, it turns out to be a toss-up. But that's not a big part of how most of us drive day to day. So if you're in stop-and-go traffic, you're definitely burning a lot more fuel because of air conditioning. And the estimates for the United States are 7 to 10 billion gallons of gasoline per year to run our air conditioners.
If you've just tuned in, this is Radio EcoShock, and we're hoping to avoid going to air-conditioned hell here. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is the author of Losing Our Cool, Stan Cox. Stan, people have suggested that global warming will reduce energy costs because we won't need to heat so many homes and businesses. Do you think that will work out?
Well, it will reduce energy consumption due to heating, but some of the same studies that have looked into global use have found that overall in the future with this huge increase in air conditioning that over the next 20 years or so, the increase in cooling energy will cancel out the gains made by reducing heating energy. And then after that point, we're going to see a big increase in overall indoor climate control energy because cooling will be taking off further in this kind of vicious circle between global warming and air conditioning. And there's one important thing to remember. Overall, if you look at the Energy Department figures, say in the United States, we still burn, we consume a lot more BTUs of energy for heating than we do for cooling. Not a lot more, but more. But if you compute the greenhouse gas emissions, and you account for the fact that the cooling is being run largely by coal-fired power plants, whereas a lot of heating is natural gas and other things. And if you add in the impact of refrigerants and the impact of the gasoline burned to cool cars, then the emissions now from cooling are about the same as those from heating. And they're certainly, if we have more years like we've had in the past few years, and if it keeps getting warmer in both the winter and summer, cooling is going to start dominating our energy.
Well, Stan, let me read one paragraph from your article in the Guardian newspaper published on July 10, 2012. And this kind of blew my mind. Quote, according to a recent forecast by Guus Velders of the Netherlands National Institute for Public Health and the Environment and his colleagues, refrigerants that accumulate in the atmosphere between now and 2050, increasing the HFCs, mostly from refrigeration and air conditioning, they will add another 14% to 27% to the increased warming caused by all human-generated carbon dioxide emissions, end quote. So we're not talking about all the greenhouse gases coming from generating electricity to power those billions of air conditioners, as frightening as that may be. No, this Dutch report is just about the refrigerants, those chemicals hiding in the back of all our refrigerators and air conditioners, adding another 25% to all our warming of the planet, maybe. Stan, how could that be?
Well, the refrigerants that make air conditioning and refrigeration work are an interesting bunch of compounds, and there's some confusion out there about it. We have replaced Freon and the CFCs that were the big ozone troublemakers and were breaking down our protective ozone layer. They've been replaced, though, with other compounds that, although they're ozone friendly, they're very climate unfriendly, as CFCs were. Some of them are thousands of times as have thousands of times the global warming impact of carbon dioxide pound for pound. So there's a big effort in trying to do something to replace those with more climate friendly compounds. And so far, that isn't getting very far. The result is that currently in the United States, probably about 20% of the total climate impact of air conditioning is because of the refrigerants, and the other 80% because of energy. With the huge increase in air conditioning and refrigeration worldwide, there's concern that this huge new production of refrigerants to circulate in those appliances is going to have, as you can add up, it's going to have a tremendous impact.
I guess some of that will be a few years down the line, because it'll stay in, we hope, the refrigerator or the air conditioner for a while until it's recycled or it's broken down or thrown away, and then it escapes into the atmosphere. Is that the way it works?
Right. And there are ways that those things are supposed to be captured and destroyed, but that's a very expensive process. And in the meantime, all of these appliances around the world that still have the refrigerants in them that are both climate and ozone unfriendly are aging. And so it's kind of a continuous pipeline of gases that are coming out. And then production of these refrigerants also can release important greenhouse gases. Elizabeth Rosenthal of the New York Times has been writing a series of articles this summer exposing the impact of refrigerants. And one of the stories she told here recently is about 19 companies around the world that are producing one of these ozone-friendly but very climate-unfriendly refrigerants. That refrigerant, the process of producing it produces a side or a byproduct that's even more climate unfriendly. It's one of the worst chemicals known for the climate. So the UN and European carbon programs give companies carbon credits for destroying this byproduct. But the unintended consequence of that is, because these companies get paid such a huge amount to destroy this nasty byproduct, they've actually been overproducing the somewhat less nasty end product so that they can get paid to destroy the byproduct. So a policy that was intended to reduce the climate impact of refrigerants has actually encouraged companies to overproduce climate unfriendly refrigerants.
It's actually a multi-billion dollar scam at this point, I'd say.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You know, Stan, what about the argument that we need air conditioning to save lives during extreme heat waves?
Well, I'm always careful to say that I don't believe in depriving people who need extra cooling in serious heat waves of that cooling as a health measure. But I think that the use of air conditioning as a public health tool in these extreme heat waves is a very different thing from the routine lavish use of air conditioning in the day-to-day world, even on just normally hot summer days, but especially the sort of habit that not just as individuals, but as a society that we're in of keeping buildings closed up, switching the thermostat from heating to cooling in April, switching it back in October, and never taking advantage of the outdoor environment and the natural cooling that doesn't cost anything and is better all around for people.
And when we pump hot air outside into the streets, doesn't that add to the heat island effect, making air conditioning seem more necessary?
That's right. It doesn't add to global warming, but you're right, it adds to local warming. There have been studies of this, for example, in southern Europe, where you have fairly tall buildings lining very narrow streets, and it's an arms race. Then the window air conditioners are pumping out hot air, and it's being trapped between the buildings, and so all of the air conditioners are having to work harder to get it out. I remember I was at a major hospital a couple of years ago, and they had a lot of features trying to make patients and their families more comfortable, and so they had a really nice courtyard out there that was a rest garden or something like that. But the outlets for the air conditioners were aimed right at the thing, so you know, sitting in that garden, you would just get blasted with hot air and probably undermining the health of the very people who are trying to have their health improved.
It's like sitting in front of a hairdryer or something. This is Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock with author Stan Cox. His book is called Losing Our Cool. Stan, I'm a little bit heartened to hear the Japanese Bankers Association has called for an end to wearing jackets and ties in their offices. They want to set the thermostat to 82 degrees inside, since the shutdown of nuclear power slashed the available energy in Japan. That does show we could change some of these slightly crazy long-term habits, maybe even take off our ties. Once an energy shortage looms, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, that is probably the comment I've heard more than any other since the book came out. It comes from people who work in large offices who are saying, I'm sick of having to carry a sweater or a space heater to work in July, or I dread going into the grocery store because I'm freezing to death in there. And so that's the kind of low-hanging fruit there that we could use to reduce the overcooling. And then, as you say, by changing dress and work habits, be able to let the temperature warm up even more. There's what's called the adaptive model of comfort, and it says that we don't just have a fixed range of comfortable temperatures, but that depending on what we've experienced in previous days or weeks, our comfort range can expand and contract, and it can move up and down. They found, for example, that office workers in Southeast Asia, when they exposed them to different temperatures and then compared workers who worked in air-conditioned spaces with those who didn't, the people who worked in normally and naturally ventilated spaces were perfectly happy up to temperatures in well into the 80s, whereas the people who were sort of habituated to air conditioning were not comfortable there. But that requires changes in the way we dress and also changes in air movement. There needs to be ventilation, free ventilation through a space like that. Actually, an air-conditioned space that is, say, somewhere in the 80s can be stifling sometimes, simply because there's no air movement, it feels very closed in. Whereas at that same temperature or even warmer, if windows are open and fans are going, it can be extremely comfortable.
Well, I notice you're speaking all over and becoming the go-to guy for media on air conditioning. Are you planning to update your book, or is there another project you have going?
The paperback edition just came out, but it is unchanged from the original. I'm thinking that because so much more new information is coming out, like what was in the Yale 360 article, a lot of people publishing good studies, that it would be a good idea to have an updated edition of it. The book that I'm working on now, or that I just finished and it's in the editing typesetting phase now, is also with the new press and is going to be titled Any Way You Slice It, about the past, present, and future of rationing. And that's another big subject, but the basic idea is that it's not just air conditioning, of course. It's a big example, but we're going to have decreases in our use of energy and other resources across the board. And nothing should be off the table, and that, in fact, really the only fair way to do that is to have an overall ceiling on consumption of resources. And then once we've done that, to decide what is a fair share and to see that we all stay within our global share of resource consumption.
Why do I think we won't hear about that at the Republican National Convention?
Well,
it's a tough idea.
The right talks a lot about rationing. If you listen to the climate deniers and so forth, they're rationing to them is the ultimate evil and something that looms in our future if we decide to be serious about the environment. And so, they may like me. They may think, well, this guy's at least being frank about it. But of course, they're all wrong in all of their assumptions about it.
And the last time that I remember a real good rationing system was during World War II, and for good reasons. The resources had to be steered in a certain direction to win the war, and I think that's what is coming up. We're kind of in a war for survival here with climate change and peak oil and a whole lot of other problems. From Salinas, Kansas, we've been talking with senior scientist and author Stan Cox. Stan, where can people keep up with what you're doing? Have you got a website for us?
LosingOurCool.com.
Good. LosingOurCool.com. Stan Cox, thank you so much for joining us again on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith. Find out more, and you can download this interview from my blog at ecoshock.info. You are listening to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. This week, we're looking at air conditioning. Are we heading into artificially cooled caves as the outdoor becomes unbearably hot? In some places, anyone who can has already abandoned the summer streets, traveling between air-conditioned rooms and air-conditioned cars. If the grid fails or electricity becomes too much to pay for, what then? Our next guest, Gus Belders, advises governments and the United Nations on both ozone depletion and climate change. Then we'll take a quick world snapshot from Dr. Michael Sivak. Of course, we could always listen to this guy. Maybe he's not high on 100 painkillers anymore, but Rush Limbaugh's brain takes him on some strange excursions. In this quick clip, he explains how air conditioning makes you think global warming is happening, even when it's not.
I have a theory about global warming and why people think it's real. Go back 30, 40 years when there was much less air conditioning in the country. When you didn't have air conditioning and you left the house, may in fact have gotten a little cooler out there, because sometimes houses become hot boxes. 30, 40 years later, all this air conditioning. And it's a huge difference when you go outside. When you go outside now, my golly, is it hot. Oh, global warming.
Thanks, Rush. It feels hotter because we have air conditioning. Never mind all those temperature records shattered and measured by those newfangled thermometers or the melting poles. Who needs science when we've got you? Radio EcoShock will be right back.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We are listening to previously recorded interviews about the risks and climate impact of counting on air conditioning as the world rapidly warms. This is Radio EcoShock.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Could the cooling chemicals in your refrigerator or air conditioner help tip the world into massive heating? Yes, says expert Gus Felders, as billions more units are sold in the developing world if we use the same chemicals. Dr. Gus Felders is an expert's expert. He works at the Netherlands Environmental Assessment Agency as a senior scientist on ozone depletion, climate change, and air quality. Felders advises the Dutch government, the European Environment Agency, and makes assessments for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the United Nations Environment Program, and more. So, Gus Felders, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's hard to believe small amounts of chemicals in my fridge or air conditioner could have a big impact on the climate in coming decades. We will get to those details, but can you give us a quick thumbnail? How serious is this refrigerant problem?
I think it is serious. You talk about small amounts. I think in a refrigerator there's a few ounces are in there of refrigerant, but the effect on climate is a few thousand times more powerful than that of other gases. So it's not so much the amount of the chemicals, but it's the power of the molecules itself to affect climate.
So now we're using relatively new chemicals, though, CFCs and HFCs. Maybe we should lay that groundwork. Could you talk to us just for a minute about what CFCs are and their role in damaging the ozone?
Yeah, I'm always a bit careful with doing interviews talking about all the chemicals, because you so easily confuse all the chemicals when you talk about CFCs and then HCFCs and HFCs. So let's try to split it up. I usually talk about, for the past, about the ozone-depleting chemicals, and then compounds like CFC-11, CFC-12. Those were the powerful ozone-depleting gases which have been used until a few years ago. Those gases are now almost globally phased out, so they cannot be used anymore, and they've been replaced by other chemicals, which some still have an effect on the ozone layer, so still are ozone-depleting gases, but other compounds don't have any effect on the ozone layer. So it's a transition from using different chemicals, which all affect climate, with a different flavor for the ozone layer. It's a different mix of gases they're using now.
So after the Montreal Protocol, it was first agreed in 1987, I know it's still being developed, the cooling industry provided a replacement that was safe for consumers but not for the climate. Gus, could you tell us about HFCs?
Yeah, I should first say that HFCs, so those are similar gases like the CFCs, the ozone-depleting chemicals, only they've replaced in the molecules the chlorine and bromine atoms with fluorine and hydrogen atoms, which makes them harmless to the ozone layer, but still powerful negative effects for climate.
And moving to 2009, you said the Montreal Protocol may have accomplished more to control climate change than even the first stage or commitment of the Kyoto Protocol, but you warned we needed to rein in HFCs or lose that progress, and you said HFC emissions could be equivalent to 6 or even 8 billion tons of carbon dioxide by 2010. Do we know how much of these gases are escaping these days?
We know quite well how much is escaping because we measure the concentrations of the gas in the atmosphere. And from there we can derive how much is being emitted. And like you said, what we've calculated a few years ago is that the Montreal Protocol was not only beneficial for the ozone layer, but especially also for the climate treaty, and much more effective than the Kyoto Protocol for climate was. And then the side effect is that because of the Montreal Protocol, the different chemicals like HFCs are being used, and they have then a more negative effect. So we might lose the benefit we got from the Montreal Protocol. We might lose if we don't take any additional action or voluntary action or whatever.
Well, in my reading of the graphs that were in your 2009 paper, and I'm only doing this roughly, HFC consumption by developing countries appears to reach the same levels as we have in the developed countries pretty soon, around 2015 or 2018. And then the radiative forcing, which is what really counts here from HFC use in those developing countries, would equal all the developed countries a little bit later, maybe 25, 2030. And then it takes off in a big steep curve upwards that indicates big impacts on the climate could happen.
That's, of course, a scenario we have. We don't know exactly what will happen. We assumed that what you now already see in Asia, that there's a large economic growth and large population growth, and population growth in China like 8 or 9% per year. And when that continues for a couple of years, and then we don't need the 8 or 9%, but we assume on average something like 3 or 4% per year. And that in combination with the large population growth, well, refrigerators and air conditioners are something, it's a luxury product. When you get a bit more wealthy, then you'd like to have a refrigerator, especially if you, when you live in Asia. So it's something which is likely to happen also in those countries, like it happened in the U.S. and in Europe a couple of years ago. So it's likely that with the combination of the large population growth and economic development, those countries will start consuming more and more compounds which could use HFCs.
Well, we were told by another guest, Stan Cox, that the air conditioning in Mumbai alone uses about 40% of all the electricity used by that big city. So they're sprouting up all over Asia.
I've heard similar numbers, yeah. And that's in air conditioning. And also look at the refrigeration. I've heard numbers that about the same in Mumbai, that about half of the crop which is harvested on the land gets lost because it cannot be refrigerated. So it's likely that when you get a bit more money, that you like a cooling so you can keep your food in good shape before it gets to the market.
Well, all of us want that. We've got it, so probably it's going to happen there.
Exactly.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Our guest is climate and ozone expert Gus Velders from the Netherlands Environmental Assessment Agency. How are HFCs and other refrigerants escaping from consumer and commercial air conditioners and refrigeration? How do they reach the atmosphere?
For example, HFCs are now the standard refrigerant in the mobile air conditioning. That's a very classical one. And clearly, in a car, everything is shaking. It's very difficult to keep it tight. And their leakage rate, so from the charge you have in there, that about 15% leaks every year out of your car from the refrigerant, and you have to replace it. And of course, when you have a home refrigerator, it's much more stable, there's much less leakage. But then at the end of life, you have to make sure that it's not just put on a landfill or being shipped to Africa, but that you take care of the refrigerant and you remove it and destroy it or you reuse it.
Well, Gus Velders, are refrigerants being collected effectively in Europe or North America?
I know in my own country, in the Netherlands, I know the ozone depleting gases must be collected. The refrigerant itself, I don't think it has to be. And I'm not sure about the U.S. and Canada, but I'm pretty sure that in a lot of the less developing countries, it's not collected. And that's where we're expecting the large growth. So if you don't develop also your regulation with the economic development, you might lose what you gained before.
Right, and you've projected, if I'm getting this right, that refrigerants accumulating in the atmosphere by 2050 could add another 14 to 27% to the increased warming from all human-made carbon dioxide emissions. Now, did I get that right?
I believe we use a number, in a radiator forcing, we use a number like 10 to 20%. That's usually what I quote.
But that's, you know, going forward, we're saying refrigerants could add 20% or more to the impacts of current use of runaway use of fossil fuels all over the world. It sounds like a recipe for disaster, climate disaster to me. What can be done about this?
What can be done? There are things which are being negotiated internationally among the Montreal Protocol and by the Kyoto Treaty. But international negotiations are going very slowly, especially when you look at climate the last couple of years. So parties have proposed to include controls on HFCs under the Montreal Protocol. And there's strong support for it by some countries, like they have been proposed by the United States, Canada, and Mexico, and by Micronesia, but also strong opposition by several Asian countries. And also because in the Montreal Protocol, there's always good progress because it was a successful treaty and parties would like to participate in a successful treaty. But now when the climate negotiations, in fact, entered the Montreal Protocol, everything became much more complicated. Other people came in there, other negotiators, and there's some sort of deadlock now with these negotiations.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. And there's a series of articles in the New York Times that suggest that there are much safer chemicals, at least for the climate, available right now. Have you heard about that?
Yeah. For not for all applications, but for a large number of sectors, there are very good alternatives already commercially available. It's not in all circumstances, but in a lot of circumstances you can use commercially ready alternatives. And like you said, if you look at insulation in buildings, when you use mineral wool instead of an HFC for the insulation for making the walls, well, you don't have any indirect effect from the chemicals, any direct effect from the chemicals. And also in other applications, like refrigeration, air conditioning, you can use hydrocarbons. In my refrigerator at home, there's a hydrocarbon in there, which is small unit, very safe. In other applications, you're using ammonia or even CO2 as a coolant, as a refrigerant. Of course, it depends on where you use it. You don't want to use ammonia, which is toxic, in an environment which can be exposed to people. But when you can build it this way, that you have somewhere outside a building and then transport the cooled air inside, you can still do it safe. So there are a lot of applications where it's already possible to use alternatives which are good for both the ozone layer and for climate.
This is Radio EcoShock with Dutch scientist Gus Velders. While we have you on the line, I know you're a published expert on the relationships between ozone and climate change. In fact, you were a lead author in an IPCC special report on that subject. And it stumps many people. I get countless well-meaning people saying we have to stop the ozone hole to save the planet from climate change. Can you talk to us about the relationship between those two subjects?
I know for the public it's always very confusing. In my view, you have to first consider them separately. The ozone layer is caused by chlorine and bromine chemicals, man-made, which are going into the atmosphere and which reach altitudes like between 12 and 20 kilometers. And there they destroy the ozone, which protects us from harmful ultraviolet radiation. That's a different issue than climate. Climate is, at first instance, caused by emissions from greenhouse gases, and most notably, it's CO2, also largely man-made with different gas. But of course, we're talking about one atmosphere, and there are all sorts of interactions. So climate change affects how the ozone layer recovers. And these ocean-depleting gases we're talking about also have an influence on climate. Although it's not a primary gas, it still has a significant influence, which could be 10-20% now and in the future. So it's one atmosphere, and there are all sorts of interactions. But in principle, ozone layer and climate change are separate issues.
But it does make it complicated. We're going to have to control several things at once. We have to fight to regulate carbon dioxide and stop using fossil fuels, frankly, and at the same time still work on HFCs as well. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. That's also making it in the international negotiations so complicated. I once told a colleague, if you want an agreement which can solve everything, it probably takes forever to get a deal. So the Montreal Protocol is targeted to one group of chemicals and more or less one chemical industry branch, and climate is tackling another group. And keeping it separate is also keeping it a bit more simple. But because of the interactions and the negative interactions, these interactions also come into the negotiations that you have to tackle climate also in the Montreal Protocol, and you have to consider it both.
Well, that sounds like a reasonable strategy to me. Gus, what are you working on these days?
We're still working on the HFCs now and looking into if we can improve the scenarios which we developed before. Because every few years, we have to see if the scenario you developed before, if it's still valid. If there are new developments, new chemicals coming onto the market, and that's the case already for mobile air conditioning, for example. You want to see if those chemicals don't have other negative side effects. Because now, when in the beginning, you better try to warn the people early on, instead of in 10 years' time to say, hey, you should have done it differently. So we want to keep track of what's developing with the phase-out of the ocean-depleting chemicals and what the chemical industry is doing now.
I think we've taken a reasonable attempt at a difficult subject. Is there something you'd like to say to sort of wrap it up for listeners, something they should remember about this?
One thing I told you about the international negotiations now going on, and it's, the difficulty there is that there are developing countries and developed countries which both have a different starting point. I think that's the difficulty in both the climate negotiations and the Montreal Protocol negotiations. Both are at goodwill, but it's hard to, from a different starting point, they have different perspectives, that you can easily reach the same goal. Maybe it's now more difficult with the financial crisis also, which makes those negotiations even more difficult.
Right. Everybody's struggling. We've been talking with Dr. Gus Velders. He's a senior scientist from the Environmental Protection Agency in the Netherlands and an expert for world bodies working on both ozone protection and climate change. Thank you for lending us your valuable time.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. This is the Radio EcoShock special, Heading for Air Conditioned Hell. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for tuning in. If you missed part of this program, download it later as a free MP3 from our website at ecoshock.org. You can pass it around as well. Sign up for our weekly podcast while you are there. The show notes for each program are at ecoshock.info. Dr. Michael Sivak is the Director of Sustainable Worldwide Transportation at the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. He's looked at the energy we use to heat and cool, coming up with useful suggestions for where you might want to live, who's next for the air conditioning boom, and how the world should count carbon emissions. Michael, I'd like to take a lightning tour through three of your papers. Let's start with the earliest, Where to Live in the United States, Combined Energy Demand for Heating and Cooling in the 50 Largest Metropolitan Areas. I find that intriguing. Energy costs, with the exception of natural gas, just keep going up, and about 35 million Americans move around anyway. Where should people go to pay the lowest energy bills and reduce their climate footprint?
When you combine the demand for heating and cooling, a clear pattern emerges. First, the least demand for interior climate control is in California. On the other hand, the upper Midwest and Northeast fare the worst.
Well, this paper was published in 2008. Since then, we have had scorching years with milder winters, and there's going to be more of that as the climate changes. According to your paper, from Florida right across the South, Americans already use more energy for cooling than heating. I'm wondering, if the world warms a few degrees, places like New England might require less energy. What do you think?
Yes, that is the case. However, the proportional reduction in the energy used to heat there will be smaller than the increase in the energy used to cool in our hot cities. This is because currently we use more energy to heat in the north than to cool in the south.
All right. And for right now, though, where should people trying to cut their energy bills consider living if they are going to move?
San Diego is by far the best, and Minneapolis the worst.
Were there any surprising findings in this paper?
Yes, indeed. Most people consider living in the desert cities such as Phoenix and Las Vegas to be the worst from the point of view of sustainability. However, the total demand for energy there for climate control is actually less than in northern cities like Minneapolis and Milwaukee. So from this point of view, it is less sustainable to live in Minneapolis than in Phoenix.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Michael Sivak from the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. Michael, let's go to the global scale now with your article titled Potential Energy Demand for Cooling in the 50 Largest Metropolitan Areas of the World, Implications for Developing Countries. In the U.S., you found heating homes still used more energy than cooling, as you say. Does that hold true for the biggest world cities?
It turns out that the future pattern for the biggest cities of the world is just the opposite from the current pattern in the U.S., with most of the world's megacities potentially needing more energy to cool than to heat. This will happen once people there will be able to afford air conditioning, because most of these megacities are in developing countries.
And I've just looked at photos and figures for air conditioning in Mumbai, India, the former Bombay. You did a stunning calculation 4 years ago about that potential power demand for cooling just in that one city alone. Can you tell us about that?
As an example of the impending huge increase in the demand for cooling, I used the climatological and population data to estimate the latent demand for air conditioning in Mumbai. The calculations indicate that the potential cooling demand in the city of Mumbai is about a quarter of the demand for the entire United States.
Just that one city alone?
Yep. Scary statistics.
I traveled throughout India in the late 1970s, and hardly anything was air-conditioned. Hotels had those giant ceiling fans in every room. And now cooling gobbles up more electricity than they can produce, blacking out big power grids. Why is the developing world going full speed into air conditioning?
for the same reason that we are doing it, namely comfort in the first place, followed by health and productivity.
Is there any science to say that productivity increases once you cool buildings down?
Yes, there is some evidence indicating that people are more productive in a certain range of temperatures.
And after India and China, where is the biggest potential growth of this demand for cooling?
The next in line are Indonesia, Nigeria, Bangladesh, Brazil, and the Philippines. Each has the potential to exceed the energy used for air conditioning in the United States.
Each one of those countries?
Yes.
Wow. Well, now more people are living in cities than in rural areas, and that trend is accelerating. We know leafy natural landscapes add cooling, while cities develop that heat island effect that you mentioned, which raises temperatures several degrees. And when we add in the trend that you also mentioned towards higher incomes and global warming, I worry people will need air conditioning in cities just to survive, and that will make climate change and energy shortages even worse. Michael Sivak, do you share that concern?
Very much so. However, I do not see any easy solutions because it would be very difficult to ask people in developing countries to forego amenities that we have been privileged to use for a long time.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Professor Michael Sivak from the University of Michigan. Perhaps you've seen, listeners, rankings of countries based on their emissions per capita. Michael Sivak says those aren't fair unless we also count each nation's real need for heating and cooling. That's in a recent publication in American Scientist, written with Brandon Shuttle. This article is called Accounting for Climate in Ranking Countries' Carbon Dioxide Emissions. In a way, Michael, this builds on your earlier studies. You seem to be saying people in other countries have a right to be as comfortable as we are. If we ever agree on a fair distribution of greenhouse gas emissions, we have to count it in. I'm sure you can explain it better than that. What is this paper about?
The basic premise of the paper is that the population of a country cannot choose the local climate. Generally, people live where they live because the mobility of most people in other countries of the world is rather limited. Therefore, in ranking countries on the amount of emissions, we need to also consider the local climate. This is the case because climate control itself generates emissions. So in this paper, we divided emissions per capita and per GDP in a given country by a climatological measure that takes into account the extent of the need to heat and cool.
And calculating those carbon allowances based on heating and cooling seems like common sense, but does this approach necessarily hurt countries like the United States or Britain?
Just the opposite. Doing so improves the ranking for both countries, but both countries end up nowhere near the least emitting countries. From among the 157 countries we examined, the U.S. moved to be the 110th least emitting country and Britain the 58th.
Well, if we shift the country rankings from simple carbon dioxide emissions to factor in that existing climate, the whole view changes. For example, how does Jordan become a heavy emitter while Sweden becomes a low emitter?
This is the case because countries with a large demand for heating and or cooling, such as Sweden, will see an improvement in their ranking. On the other hand, countries with a relatively small demand for climate control, such as Jordan, they'll usually see a worsening in their ranking.
And how does Australia measure up when we count for emissions produced versus the given climate?
This is a good example. Australia drops from being the 126th best to being the 151st or the 7th worst.
And Michael Sivak, what is next for you? What are you working on now?
I'm looking at the future demand for cooling in all developing countries.
And how will you do that?
This study is an extension of the work I did on cooling demand in the largest metropolitan area. So I'm using the same methodology, but now I'm looking at the entire countries and comparing them to the demand in the U.S. as a yardstick.
Dr. Michael Sivak is the Director of Sustainable Worldwide Transportation at the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute. Michael, thank you so much for talking with us.
Many thanks for having me.
As we feel the rumble of the oncoming climate train, I'm not going to count on prayer alone. Activism and action can preserve a livable world, I believe that. Next week, we'll hear about the beginnings in localization and the transition movement. I'm Alex Smith. You can contact me through our website at ecoshock.org. Radio EcoShock isn't a music show, even though good sound often sustains me through tough times. But when I heard this new song by the Dave Matthews Band, I had to share it with you. It's called Mercy. You just heard Heading to Air Conditioned Hell, three interviews broadcast in September 2012. To learn more, check out my show blog at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Can't give up and hope God will intercede. Come on back. Imagine that we could get it together and stand up for where we need to be. 'Cause crying won't save or feed a hungry child. Can't lay down and wait for a miracle to change things. So lift up your eyes, lift up your heart, singing, mercy, will we overcome this? Oh, one by one, could we turn it around? Maybe carry on just a little bit longer. And I try to give you what you need. Me and you and you and you, we just wanna be free, yeah, yeah. But you see, all the world is just as we've made it. And until we got a new world, I got to say that love is not a whisper or a weakness. No, love is strong. We got to get together, yeah. Gotta get. So there is no reason to fight. Mercy, will we overcome this? Yeah, one by one, could we turn it around? Baby, carry on just a little bit longer. And I'll try to give to me. Oh, we come too far to turn it around. Oh, yeah.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Edward Said on Palestine and the Universality of Human Rights. As I'm preparing this archival program for rebroadcast at the end of June 2020, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to announce his government's annexation of major areas of the Israeli-occupied Palestinian West Bank, including the Jordan Valley. Such an act would eliminate whatever possibility remained of creating a Palestinian state side by side with Israel. That had been stated U.S. policy prior to the election of Donald Trump. Netanyahu would be doing this despite vocal opposition from all sectors of Palestinian society, as well as from Arab governments and Israel's Western allies. Even some of Israel's most stalwart supporters in the U.S. are concerned about Israel's decreasing popularity among younger American voters. At times like these, Edward Said's wisdom and authority are desperately missed. On September 25, 2003, a message made its way around the world. Edward Said, Palestinian American, world famous professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University, and fearless defender of the Palestinian cause, had died of leukemia in New York City, far from the city of Jerusalem, where he was born in 1935. This is a tribute to Edward Said, a recording of his last major talk on Palestine, recorded by TUC Radio only 7 months before his death. Here is Edward Said before a capacity audience of over 2,000 at the University of California, Berkeley, on the eve of the invasion of Iraq.
I'm incredibly moved and flattered to see all of you here tonight. This is a very fraught moment to be speaking about human rights in the Middle East, and those of the Palestinian people in particular. The United States has already sent a hugely intimidating military force to various Arab and non-Arab countries in the region surrounding Iraq. It is the people of Iraq who stand to suffer the most, and whose doubly and triply miserable fate is of the deepest interest to people all over the world. I'm sorry to say that none of this has had the slightest effect on what is a granitic will on the part of a tiny number of members of George Bush's administration to go forward with plans for a war among whose stated imperial intentions is the unilateral wish to bring American-style democracy to Iraq and the Arab world, redrawing maps, overturning governments and states and modes of life on a fantastically wide scale in the process. That all this has very little to do with the enhancements of human rights in a part of the world especially rife with their abuse is patently obvious. This is a war planned for resources and for strategic control. The U.S. has at very least asserted its strategic dominance over the center of the world's largest known energy reserves, from the Gulf to the Caspian Sea, and plans to reshape the area by pacifying threats to its dominance in countries like Syria, Iran, and some of the Gulf Emirates. To threaten war with such belligerence and such a wasteful deployment of military resources is an abuse of human tolerance and human values. Note also that by the end of the decade, China will be importing as much oil as the U.S., and by 2025, the United States will need to import a full 75% of its oil needs from the Gulf region, principally. As against those mighty facts, whether people are prevented from getting an education or from being allowed to move, express themselves, and organize freely without fear, either of intimidation, collective punishment, or straight-out assassination may seem, therefore, like relatively humdrum, if not trivial, issues. but they do pertain with a frightening parallelism to both the people of Palestine and the people of Iraq. In either and both cases, my point here is to assert the universal applicability of human rights to those unfortunate people, given that since World War II, there has grown up an impressive, even formidable, worldwide consensus that each individual or collectivity, no matter his or her color, ethnicity, religion, or culture, is to be protected from such horrific practices as starvation, torture, forced transfer of population, discrimination on the basis of religion or ethnos, humiliation, extrajudicial political assassinations, land expropriations, and all manner of similar cruel and unusual punishment. I want to affirm also that no power, no matter how special or how developed or how strong or how urgent its claims of past victimization, is exempt from accusation and judgment if that government practices such things. Once big powers start to dream of regime change, a process already begun by the Pearls and Wolfowitzes of this country, there's simply no end in sight. Isn't it outrageous that people of such a dubious caliber actually go on blathering about bringing democracy, modernization, and liberalization to the Middle East? Heaven knows that the area needs it, as so many Arab and Muslim intellectuals and ordinary people have said over and over. But who appointed these characters as agents of progress anyway? And what entitles them to pontificate in so shameless a way when there are already so many injustices and abuses in our own country to be remedied? It's particularly galling that Pearl, about as unqualified a person as it is imaginable to be on any subject except, I'm told, souffles, and any subject touching on democracy and justice should have been an election advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu's extreme right-wing government during the 1996-99 period, in which he counseled the right-wing Israeli to scrap any and all peace attempts to annex the West Bank and Gaza and try to get rid of as many Palestinians as possible. This man and his colleagues now talk about bringing democracy to the Middle East and does so without provoking the slightest objection from any of the media pundits who politely, if not abjectly, quiz him on national television. Colin Powell's speech at the UN, despite its many weaknesses, its plagiarized and manufactured evidence, its confected audio takes, which to anybody who knows Arabic are completely senseless, as well as its doctored pictures, is correct in one thing. Saddam Hussein's regime has violated numerous human rights and UN resolutions. There can be no arguing about that, and no excuses. But what is so tremendously hypocritical about the official U.S. position in the U.S. is that literally everything Powell has accused the Iraqi Baathis of has been the stock and trade of every Israeli government since 1948. And at no time more flagrantly since the occupation of 1967. Torture, illegal detention, assassination, assaults against civilians with missiles, helicopters and jet fighters, the annexation of territory, the transportation of civilians from one place to another for the purpose of imprisonment, mass killing, as in Qana, Jenin, Sabra and Shatila, to mention only the most obvious, the denial of rights to free passage and unimpeded civilian movement, education, medical aid, the use of civilians for human shields, humiliation, punishment of families, house demolitions on a mass scale, destruction of agricultural land, expropriation of water, illegal settlements, economic pauperization, attacks on hospitals, medical workers and ambulances, the killing of UN personnel, to name only the most outrageous abuses. All these, it should be noted with emphasis, have been carried on with the total, unconditional support of the United States, which has not only supplied Israel with the weapons for such practices and every kind of military and intelligence aid, but has also given Israel upwards of $135 billion in economic aid on a scale that beggars the relative amount per capita spent by our government on its own citizens. This is an unconscionable record to hold against the U.S. and the Secretary of State as its human symbol in particular. As the person in charge of U.S. foreign policy, it's his specific responsibility to uphold the laws of this country and to make sure that the enforcement of human rights and the promotion of freedom is applied uniformly without exception or condition. How he and his co-workers can stand up before the world and righteously sermonize against Iraq while at the same time completely ignoring the ongoing American partnership in human rights abuses with Israel defies credibility. And yet no one in all the justified critiques of the U.S. position that have appeared since Powell made his great U.N. speech has focused on this point. And that is what I want to do this evening. History is made by men and women. And the world we live in is a secular and historical world as a result. History is therefore the product of human labor, choice, and will. Nothing transcendental or divine can supersede that truth or suspend the consequences that flow from its application. There simply is no convincing way to assert special claims whose origin is the divine. Claims that supposedly legitimate high altitude or smart bombing or the use of 60-ton bulldozers to demolish the houses of poor and defenseless people who don't happen to belong to the right religion or race. Just as I feel as an American that the United States has not been divinely endowed with a special errand into the wilderness and that its practices are endorsed by God, I feel it's my moral and intellectual duty to oppose the unjust use of its immense military, economic, and political power abroad for what is, it claims falsely, to be its national security interests. I have no power, so I must resort to the tools of education, to writing and speaking. By the same token, I want to reiterate my conviction here that the specific case of the denial of the human rights of the Palestinian people by the State of Israel cannot at all be justified on any of the grounds routinely accepted by far too many individuals and governments who would be the first to object to similar behavior in other cases. So far from Israel and the Palestinians being a special case of unusual circumstances, I think the exact opposite is true, that because Palestine is perhaps of all places on earth the one most densely saturated with cultural and religious significance, precisely that reality makes it an instance of universality thwarted and flouted. The universality of human coexistence, human acceptance of the other, and the human construction of a just and fair society for all, and certainly not only some of its residents. The point is that no state at all, is entitled legitimately to object to these formulations, and certainly no leader can state unarguably, for example, as George Bush has, that the United States is good and its enemies evil, or as General Sharon has announced, and I quote, "We are placing no restrictions on our operations in the Palestinian territories. Israel is under no pressure. No one is criticizing us or has the right to do so." I would submit that such sweeping statements of higher purpose and extraordinary impunity must be opposed and intellectually dismantled for the thuggish balderdash that such pronouncements really are, especially if they're intended to cover or explain or excuse or somehow justify barbaric devastation and vast ruin. Yet the contrast between the immensely powerful and the relatively powerless is not so simple, since the great outcry all over the world against unilateral U.S. war and the felt need by even U.S. government spokespeople to reiterate a general American commitment to democracy and human rights does in fact reveal a profoundly worldly awareness that aside from comfort and convenience, human beings today expect, rightly, to be respected, their requirements for a decent life met, their wish recognized not to be tortured or to be detained unlawfully, their concern for their children and their livelihoods accepted despite the supposedly higher priorities asserted by great power. All these, in theory at least, are rarely challenged head-on and considered to be human entitlements, even if such terrible abstractions as the national interest and national unity are affirmed as superseding individual rights. This unattractive and unacceptable argument certainly now prevails in the U.S., where education and history, for example, has become a profoundly ideological battle between proponents of a kind of primitive, heroic, white American nationalism and the much more sensible advocates of the multicultural, multiracial reality stressed, for instance, in his work by the prominent historian Howard Zinn. This other American history includes a bitter legacy of domestic slavery, imperial conquest, and terrible class inequality. So the universally accepted widespread conviction that everyone on earth deserves a modicum of human rights has only a symbolic moral power, perhaps too ill-endowed to take on so redoubtable a force as American global reach and all its all too numerous local henchmen and fearsome neoconservative spokespeople who want so-called American values to rule the world, resistance and objections notwithstanding. To speak about Palestinian rights in so skewed a context, therefore, may seem quixotic. And certainly the current impression that Israel and the U.S. have borne all before them in their stubbornly ingrained hostility to Palestinian self-determination reinforces the superficial impression. But I want to argue that is not at all there is to the whole truth. There are other accomplishments and realities also to be noted with positive approbation and admiration. During my own lifetime, Palestinians, since the climactic events of 1948, when their society was destroyed and the establishment of Israel occurred, Palestinians have gone from the status of non-persons to that of a universally acknowledged national collectivity, i.e., a people, by virtue not of force of arms, but of other means, some of which I want to rehearse here. If for now Palestinians are still stateless, dispossessed, and for the most part exiled, it is because by those very unmilitary means, some of which are the mobilized force of memory, the power of images, and the heroism and ingenuity of sheer persistence, Palestinians embody perhaps the most visible and certainly the most universal case of human rights abuses on earth today. There's no desire on my part to be fetishistically competitive about such a claim, so I won't go on about it any further. But I do want to be able to talk about the visibility not only of the Palestinian presence as victims of injustice and human rights denial, but of the equal force they represent on the world stage of a wrong that must be righted. Note that in all the many different places, conditions, and politics that the approximately 7.5 million Palestinians now live in, as citizens of Israel, as people under military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, as refugees and stateless persons in several Arab countries, as refugees with various acquired nationalities scattered all over the world, and as members of a dispossessed people, Palestinians have developed a moral and political solidarity with each other, nothing less in fact than a national identity, that it has been the goal of Israel to deny, obliterate, and refuse to acknowledge as sovereign. To argue backwards for a moment, let me cite only one recent example of what I mean by denial and a refusal to acknowledge. It was precisely that refusal that flawed the Oslo process from the moment it was undertaken in 1993, alas, with unqualified and unprepared Palestinian representatives delegated to a task which was designed not to restore but to further postpone and deflect the fulfillment of Palestinian aspirations. In this, neither Israel nor the United States was moved by an acknowledgement of past injustices, nor by a spirit of contrition or of reconciliation, with their batteries of legal experts backed by disproportional military weight in both countries, and at the same time as more than double the pre-existing number of settlements were being created on Palestinian land and more human rights abused, Israel and the United States divided and subdivided, occupied and ever diminishing bits of Palestinian territory into smaller and less viable units for the unfortunate Palestinian Authority to take over and misrule, all under the misleading, not to say willfully deceptive, rubric of the peace process. The overall plan, beginning in 1948, was to start Israel as if afresh, a state arising from nothing to take its place among the nations. In the affirmation of its renewed millennial identity, Israel managed for quite a while to remove the traces of Palestinian life for the most part, even though, of course, a large number of these traces, who remained as a remnant of people despite the expulsions of 1948, were there as a humbled and scarcely perceptible presence, ruled by military government inside Israel until 1966. Even so apparently innocent a discipline as our archaeology thereafter was complicit in the making over of the land and its markers as if there had never been any Arab Palestinians there. This is chillingly described by Nadia Abulhaj in her recent book, Facts on the Ground, Archaeological Practice and Territorial Self-Fashioning in Israeli Society. Her argument is that in the process of providing Israel with an ancient, objectivized history visible in archaeological evidence, the traces of other, more historically adjunct histories were ignored or simply moved away. What remained became evidence, she says, of a kind of essential Israeliteness, giving the state a pedigree in a long distance past, with the intervening cultures and peoples pushed aside. Moreover, in a trilogy of powerful books entitled A Land Without People, The Expulsion of the Palestinians, and the third one, The Imperial Israel and the Palestinians, The Politics of Expansion, 1967 to 2000, the Palestinian-Israeli scholar Noor Masalha has unearthed both the practice and theory of emptying the land of Israel and of its indigenous inhabitants. Much of the pre-state Zionist ideology that mobilized Eastern European communities for the trek to mandatory Palestine was premised on the virtual absence of inhabitants, on what was often depicted as either a completely empty or a hopelessly arid land awaiting redemption. Later, or in some cases simultaneously with that contention, when the discovery of actual Palestinians could no longer be deferred or denied, there was a concerted effort to devise ways of spiriting them away, for which the war of 1948 provided field commanders, and David Ben-Gurion himself with a rich opportunity. These are amply attested to in the Israeli military archived, as combed assiduously by a number of Jewish as well as numerous Arab researchers, including Masalha himself. Since 1967, the desire to efface or repress what has remained of an institutionalized Palestinian life in the cities and villages of the West Bank and Gaza has remained an often explicitly stated Israeli goal, recently hidden inside the polemics of a war for Israel's survival and a defense against extremist terrorism. But whether its new Jewish citizens liked it or not, Israel was always encumbered by Palestinian memory, which is one of my themes here. It's not as if a whole existence of a people can be easily wiped away like a footprint in the sand. The sheer banality of such a possibility is too obvious to require more comment here. What I would like to note, however, is that as the resourceful Palestinian-Israeli sociologist Ahmed Saadi has shown in a brilliant piece of historical and social synthesis, the more Israel has unilaterally exerted its considerable force to bury the Palestinian past, as it were, there has been a painstaking collective and yet uncoordinated Palestinian memory that has maintained Palestinian history since the Nakba of 1948 as a tremendously potent site of memory. Cinema is one result. What has remained of the vastly dispersed and disjunctive fragments of history since 1948 have been painstakingly collected over time by individuals as objects of memory, such objects as house keys, title deeds, photographs, letters, newspaper clippings, embroideries, and so forth, and through film, fiction, poetry, oral discourse, critical and political analysis, significant or traumatic collective experiences like the Deir Yassin, Kfar Qasim, Sabra and Shatila, and Jenin events, the significant episodes of Palestinian suffering have been preserved along with the national life that bore and outlived them. I remember writing in 1982 that whenever one of us had an opportunity to speak publicly, there was a felt requirement to start narrating the national collective narrative as if from scratch. No freestanding Palestinian story was available that could place before the world the chronological sequence of dispossession and catastrophic loss that has so disfigured and mutilated contemporary Palestinian life. Such a sequence has been interdicted in all sorts of ways, far too many times, by such things as the carting off by Israeli soldiers of Palestinian archives in Beirut during the 1982 invasion. And only the other day, the Israeli occupation army similarly removed records, computers, hard drives, statistics from Palestinian offices at the Central Bureau of Statistics, the Ministry of Education, and elsewhere in the West Bank. Whether this was meant to put a stop to Palestinian national life just short of full ethnic cleansing, I don't want to speculate here, but that such procedures are of a piece with claims that Israel is fighting for its life, and that in occupying and destroying everything possible by tanks, bulldozers, F-16s, and Apache helicopters, it is defending itself against terrorists who happen to have no army or viable means of defense or means of waging war of any description, that seems totally obvious. In any event, the great narrative of Palestinian life hasn't yet been achieved any more than the fulfillment of its logical national aspirations have been fulfilled. Although it seems just as obvious that there is no regression, no flagging among Palestinians everywhere on that inexorable drive. Despite all this, a Palestinian nation in exile has emerged with an unmistakable outline and personality of its own. The vast network of institutions, groups, and collectivities scattered all over the world that sustains the continuity of Palestinian national life is an amazing thing. It has drawn not only on the mobilized energies of Palestinians everywhere, but also on the dazzlingly widespread commitment to them of their friends, allies, and comrades all over the world.
You heard the first part of a 90-minute speech by the late Professor Edward Said. News of his untimely death in September of 2003 shook the world. He is missed as a loved and respected professor of literature, a musicologist and pianist, and an eloquent defender of Palestinian sovereignty. He leaves behind a treasure of writings, including his most influential book, Orientalism, and Culture and Imperialism. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. TUCRadio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly podcasts. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening.